So if you wouldn't mind starting by just introducing yourself.
Sure. Are we rolling now?
Yeah.
Okay. Hi, I'm George R. R. Martin, and we're here in my study and library in Santa Fe, New Mexico.
Fantastic. And do you, I gotta ask, when you're forced into having to say the one word description of what you are you a writer, storyteller?
I'm a writer.
A writer.
That's fine.
Yeah. Okay.
You can use fancier words, storyteller, author, you know, entertainer, but writer is fine for me.
Okay, good. So, George, you've been writing stories, as I understand, since early days as a child.
Yes, I've been making up stories for as long as I can remember. Even from practically the time I learned to read and to write, I was like writing things myself in pads. A little, I think the oldest thing I have is an encyclopedia of space, where basically I drew a picture of different planets and put like what kind of weird people live there, watching from TV shows.
Do you still have that?
I do still have that.
Oh,
yes.
I'm
probably going to send it to Texas A&M where my papers are being held.
Yeah.
You know, when I would play a game with some of the other kids in the neighborhood, then I would want to, like, write it down afterwards if it was a particularly fun game or some cool things that happened, almost to preserve the experience. Sometimes I think it was the life that I lived. You know, I was born and raised in Bayonne, New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
I lived in my grandmother's house to the age of four, at which point my mother and father moved into the federal housing projects that had just been built down on First Street in Bayonne. We didn't have much money, so it was a low-income housing project. And that was on First Street, and I stayed there till I went away to college. So that was pretty much from age four to age 18, that was my life. And I went to school on Fifth Street, Mary Jane Donahue School in Bayonne, New Jersey. And I would walk those five blocks, but we very seldom went anywhere. We didn't even own a car. You know, I could take buses occasionally if I had to go visit my grandmother or go to a movie theater up on 25th Street. But mostly those five blocks and where I could walk was my life. And I think that in some ways helped spur my imagination. There was something in me that hungered for a wider world. And since I couldn't actually see that wider world, although I knew it was out there in real life, I turned to books and to comic books. And I turned to my imagination, imagining wider worlds, imagining distant planets or strange times. You know, I read historical fiction, fantasy. There wasn't much fantasy in those days, but what there was, I read Robert E. Howard, Tolkien in high school. And, of course, comic books. Read a lot of science fiction, starting with Robert A. Heinlein, Andre Norton, and Eric Frank Russell. All of these things opened up wonderful worlds to me and to my imagination. And I also was making up stories of my own of some of these places that I read about and some places that I just imagined.
Did you have a local library you haunted?
There was Bayonne has a Carnegie Library up on 31st Street that I would occasionally go to when I was a little older. When I was younger, there was a branch library on 5th Street, which was like in an old storefront. So it had big, it was a weird looking library, big plate glass windows and things like that.
Yeah.
But, you know, they had books, and I'd go in there. I read their entire science fiction section, which wasn't much, like 20 books. But they had a little spaceship on the spine, so I knew that that was the science fiction books, but with the spaceship on the spine. So I read my way through all of those.
Can you remember any seminal moment in your reading of that was just sort of like, the light went on, this is it? Or was it just all of them combined?
Well, as a reader, there were a number of seminal moments. I suppose the first science fiction book I read, which was Robert A. Heinlein's Have Space That Will Travel, was one of those. Up to then, I was, course, reading in school, you know, whatever they gave you to Dick and Jane stories, right, and then right. a little more sophisticated in higher grades. But my pleasure reading was all comic books. It was Batman and Superman and, you know, when I was younger, occasionally other types of comic books, the funny animal comic books, you know, Uncle Scrooge and Donald Duck and various other things. But I didn't read real books until that Heinlein book, which was, you know, an eye-opener for me. And it was given to me for Christmas by a friend of my mother's. It was a hardback, a Scribner's hardback. And I think since hardbacks cost several dollars back then, a fortune to my thing. I got an allowance of $1 a week through most of my childhood, which could buy me, you know, 10 comic books. But then, of course, when the comic book price went up to 12 cents, that was a sharp down curve, you know. I had to learn to budget very early, you know, because you had that dollar, but sometimes I wanted, like, a Milky Way bar, which cost a nickel, and then that would be one less comic book that I could buy, or, you know, if I wanted one of those little pink rubber balls to play stickball with, that had a big hit on my budget, or if I went to, you know, I remember one time I went to Uncle Milty's amusement park, which was just down the street from where we lived, and Uncle Milty's.
Okay.
And I went to Uncle Milty's, and they had a little penny arcade kind of thing that was open even in winter. The amusement park itself was open only summer, but the amusement arcade was open all the time, and they had skee ball machines.
Okay. Yeah.
And I blew my entire dollar at a nickel a game playing skee ball on the first day I'd gotten it. And then I had to go 7 whole days without any Milky Way bars, any comic books, anything. You know, I was broke. I was, you know,
destitute.
That 7 days lasted. It seemed to last like a year and a half. It was, you know, Mom, I'd like a Coke. Sorry, you spent your allowance. You know, no Coke for you. So it taught me right down to kind of marshal my money and the hard price of addiction. If you can just get sucked into that skee ball and lose all of your money right away.
So I haven't seen skee ball things around here anymore.
No skee ball, yeah. that sort of cured me of skee ball, losing a whole dollar. I guess that was 20 games. I played 20 games in succession there because it was a nickel you threw into the machine and then you...
The reading side seems clear, but the magic of writing, you had to have somebody...
Well, I was always writing all through that period. Or making up stories, didn't always finish a lot of them.
Yeah,
I had a lot of things where I would like start a story and then I'd write a few pages and I'd stop it. But it was in my head. I certainly didn't imagine I would be a writer to, you know, as a career, as a profession when I was young. I got into science fiction. You know, the whole thing about the space program, and we're now talking the 1950s and the early 1960s, it was the Mercury program and then Gemini and Apollo, all that stuff was going on. And when I was young enough, even before that stuff, I had the idea that I would not write about this great space stuff that I was reading, but I would live it. I would be like an astronaut or a test pilot or something cool like that. But then when they actually picked the Mercury 7 and the Gemini and it started happening, and I was getting older, it was beginning to dawn on me that I wasn't going to be successful in this kind of profession. For one thing, they were picking guys that were clearly jocks, which I were not. They were picking guys who were engineers for the most part. And while I loved the science fiction, I didn't necessarily love the science part of it. I always got good grades in school. I was a smart kid, but I got better grades in things like English and history than I got in, you know, chemistry or any of those scientific type subjects. So I don't know. I think it was high school when I finally made the freshman year of high school when I said, maybe I'll just write about this stuff and actually, instead of actually trying to go into orbit or land on Mars or something like that.
Did you ever have any particular writing teacher in school or anywhere that sort of inspired you or
shape? I had some great teachers, but I wouldn't necessarily say they were writing teachers.
Okay. Yeah.
I tell you, there was one incident, come to think of it. I think it was my sophomore year English in high school. when they gave us an assignment to write a new ending for the Poe's Pit and the Pendulum.
Oh.
The teacher, you know, had us read that in class. And he didn't like the ending. You know, if you recall, the Pit and the Pendulum, the guy is strapped down, right, and this pendulum is swinging lower and lower and lower, and it's going to cut him in half. But right before it happens, suddenly, like, trumpets blow, and he's saved by the miraculous arrival of his friends. And, you know, the Inquisition was in the hands of its enemies, so the pendulum stops, and he's saved. And so our teacher gave us the assignment to write a new ending. And maybe I set the mold for all of my writing to come, because basically I wrote an ending where nobody comes to rescue him, and the pendulum slices him in half, you know. First it just makes a little cut, and then it makes a deeper cut, and you know, rats come and eat him, and you know, it's a terrible ending that was much more gory and realistic. But the teacher liked how I read it.
Really?
Liked how I wrote it, and had me read it in class.
Good for your teacher.
And I got a lot of approbation that from the other boys in the class who all thought it was, you know, really cool. All the rats eating his eyes, and they, you know, the blood and the gore and all of the stuff like that. So that was probably an encouraging. It was the first sort of, hey, everybody likes this thing that I did. Maybe I'm good at doing this thing. Let's do more of it.
That's neat. Because there were always the kids that drew pictures of rats eating skulls and stuff, and we all loved to look at those pictures.
Yeah, actually, I drew a lot of pictures, too.
Did you?
Yeah, I always doodled on my stuff. There was one point, I mean, I haven't thought about this stuff in years. There was one point where I did think that I would be a cartoonist or something like that.
Ah.
I won an art award in like, kindergarten for drawing, a cowboy's horse and all that. Had a lot of details on it, so I had this won this little award. But as I got older and, you know, not older, but an older kid, I realized that, you know, the drawback of me being an artist was that I couldn't actually draw.
That detail.
You know, what had won me that art award was the fact that I put so much detail on this horse, you know, a saddle and reins and, you know, all of that stuff. I was always kind of very obsessive about the detail and getting that, and it was more than that than any actual talent for drawing that did it. So I gave up the idea of being a cartoonist or an artist, and much more gravitated towards being a spaceman, as we called it there.
Your first published piece, which was early, if I recall, do you recall anything about when somebody finally said, yes, you getting published, your name is out there?
Well, there are layers to what you mean by first published piece.
Right.
I mean, my first professionally published piece, my first published fiction, my first published words. My first published words were a letter to the editor in Fantastic Four number 20, you know. Dear Stan and Jack, Fantastic Four number 17, I think I was commented on, was greater than great, I think I'd be in it. So I was a big fan of the comic books and, of course, the Marvel comics, which had just come along in the early 60s and were a revolutionary, a breath of fresh air in the comic industry, so much better than what had gone before. And, you know, I became a Marvel fanatic very early on, and I wrote a number of letters that were published in Fantastic Four and Avengers and some of the other Marvel comics of the day. And I got involved in comics fandom, which was just starting in time. It was sort of an offshoot from the older science fiction fandom, but it was mostly being run by high school kids like me, who was a few older guys, but they published these amateur magazines called fanzines, mm-hmm. Some of which, the majority of which were basically critical magazines, you would say, or fan magazines talking about, oh, the latest issue of Fantastic Four, or who's better, the Avengers or the JLA, or, you know, doing reviews of recent comic books, a lot of amateur artwork in them, drawing mm-hmm. Captain America or Superman or whatever, and histories of old comic books. All of that was great, but I didn't have any old comic books from the Golden Age that I could write a history about. And although I did do some reviews and all that of comic books for some of the fanzines, the ones that I really responded to were there were fanzines that were publishing amateur fiction. Fan fiction, we called it, although I got to make a distinction because fan fiction has come to mean something very different.
Right.
And it's been known that I'm not a fan of fan fiction. Today, fan fiction means taking someone else's characters or world and writing unauthorized stories in it. So writing Harry Potter stories or writing Star Wars stories. That wasn't our fan fiction. Our fiction was simply fiction by fans, but about original characters that we made ourselves. And there were a number of fanzines that published this. Star-Studded Comics, which I wrote for. Batwing, another one I wrote for. Graphic Story Illustrated. A whole bunch of fanzines of varying qualities published these amateur comic strips and comic books about fan-created superheroes. Some of them were really, really terrible. But actually, I think, I wasn't a very confident kid. I guess I felt, number one, that I was, being poor and living in the projects, you face a certain amount of discrimination or it's drilled home to you that you're not quite as good as the other kids who, have more money and live in real houses and things. You're a projects kid, so there was that. And I wasn't very good at sports or anything like that. I was a kind of nose-in-the-book kind of kid. So I didn't have a lot of confidence to put my stuff out there. But when I read some of these really, really bad fanzines, I said the famous first words as opposed to famous last words, I can do better than that.
Yeah.
And suddenly I sat down and started indeed doing better than that. Now, I shouldn't say, some of it was terrible, but some of it was pretty good for being written by high school kids. A lot of it, the majority of it was, of course, amateur comic books by people who could write and draw. But by then I had already given up on the drawing. I knew I couldn't draw worth a damn, and I certainly couldn't draw as well as some of the people who were doing it, even on the amateur fanzine level. But there were also text stories, as they were called.
Text. Text stories.
T-E-X-T.
Yeah, right.
Text stories. Superhero stories told in prose. It was almost an offshoot of comic books. If you ever read comic books in the 50s or 60s, or etc., they always had, you'd be reading The Adventure of Spider-Man or Batman or whoever it was, but like in the middle of it, there would be like a one-page story completely unconnected with them, like two columns. It would just be an anecdote. It'd be a very short thing. That was to get the second-class mailing permit because the postal regulations at the time did not consider comic book stories to be literature or to be proper fiction. So if you just had a comic book, you couldn't get the second class mailing permit that allowed you to do it circulate. So all comic books had to include a text story in the middle of it. So when these kids started their amateur comic books, even though they didn't have second class mailing permits, they were just mailing them out, first class. But they still thought, all the professional comics have one of these. We better include one of these too. But that was fine. That was my niche. So I wrote these stories about Power Man and Dr. Weird and the White Raider and these other characters.
Wow.
It was fun. So that was, and my stuff was very well received. Again, it was written by a 13 and a 14 and a 15-year-old, so it's hardly great literature, but I was competing against other 13, 14, and 15-year-olds, so I got a lot of, no money for it, of course, these were strictly amateurs, but I got a lot of praise in the letter columns, I got a lot of encouragement, which really is a thing that you need at a certain point. It's tough for a starting writer, because you're really walking a tightrope here, and a lot depends on the personality of the writer, but I think you need a certain amount of encouragement to keep going, but you also need a certain amount of criticism to get better. If you get too much criticism, then you can get very discouraged. It's easy to give up. If you get too much encouragement and no criticism, then you never get better. So, yeah. But I guess I get the right combination of both. And finally, in college, I started submitting my stories to professional markets and collected a fair amount of rejection slips, but finally sold one of those stories in, I sold it in 1970, appeared in 1971, Galaxy Magazine. So that was my first professional sale, 1971 Galaxy.
Do you remember when you got the acceptance letter or the check or anything about that?
It was actually a phone call. It had been a long time. You know, I was in college at the time, so every summer I went home to Bayonne, but during the school year I was out at Northwestern in Evanston, Illinois, and I would send out these stories, and of course you always have to include a stamped self-addressed envelope, but foolishly I would put the self-addressed envelope, you know, at where I was when I sent the story out. And it kept screwing me up because, you know, I'd send it out from the dormitory, and then by the time it came back, I wouldn't be at the dormitory anymore. I'd be home for the summer, and it would go into a dead letter file or something. So, and then vice versa. I'd send a story out when I was at home with my home address on it, and then I'd be back at school by the time it arrived, and my mother would get it or something like that. So a story that I had submitted to Galaxy, it had been like 8 months or something. I hadn't heard what happened to it. And I finally called long distance. That was a big thing in those days. Even from New Jersey to New York City, I called Galaxy long distance to inquire about the story. And I got a very irritated woman on the phone who said, well, we can't keep track of all the stories we reject. I don't know. But tell me the name of your story. And I told her name. Oh, we bought that story. And that's how I found out through that phone call.
I've got to ask, what was the payment for the story?
$94.
Wow. That is impressive.
Yeah, it wasn't bad. Galaxy was a good market in those days.
Yeah, that's neat. And you must have felt...
And $94, man, I felt rich.
Yeah.
That was a lot of money.
Yeah. 940 comics.
That's right.
You must have developed some habits about your writing and how you conduct your writing. And do you work on a computer now?
Yeah, I've been working on a computer since 1982, so... Yeah.
So do you ever compose longhand or?
No.
Yeah.
I never did. I mean, not since the very earliest days.
Yeah.
I was still in grade school when I got my first typewriter, which was, I found in my aunt's attic, an old manual typewriter. I think it was an Underwood. It might have been Underwood.
Yeah.
And I wrote the stories on that, you know.
Whiteout and carbon paper and...
Well, I didn't master the art of carbon paper for a long time, and whiteout hadn't been invented. Mm. Whiteout was invented later. I'm very old, of course. So, but I remember, I learning to type myself. I only type with one finger. I still only type with,
oh, really?
With one finger. And, I was hitting the keys so hard that the O was actually cut out. So on the pages that I wrote, the O would be a little hole in paper. And I had one of those black and red ribbons, you know. They all had the black and red ribbons.
Right.
And, you know, you never use the red. What the hell is the red for, you know? So I used the red for italics, for emphasis when I was writing my manuscripts. The early comic book stories and all that.
Yeah.
So the black would be normal, and when someone was shouting or something, it would go to red. But that way I got a little use out of the red ribbon. But I always hated, it was expensive to get a new ribbon, so I would always try to stretch out the ribbons, and the black would wear out, and the red would be practically brand new, and you hated to throw out the ribbon when the red is all good, but what are you going to do? Type, I knew even then better than to type a manuscript in red, red ink, but then I went from that by the time I went to college, I had an electric typewriter. Which, of course, was much better and easier. And by then, I had started to master the art of carbon paper so I could keep copies of the things I did. And then in 1982, I went from an electric typewriter to a computer.
What was it?
My first computer, Televideo 802 CPM.
Do you have any preference as to when you write? Do you set yourself on a daily basis? Do you do, like, in the mornings? Do you...
Mornings are my best times. I mean, I get up and come over here. I have my coffee. I answer any urgent, I look at the email. There's usually a fair amount of email in the morning. I answer anything that's urgent, and then I start to write. And if I'm having a good day, I'll pretty much write for the whole day. If I'm having a bad day, you know, you write for a while, you struggle for a while, you rewrite what you did yesterday, you decide to check your email again, you try to make yourself write for a while, etc. But I'm not what you call a disciplined kind of writer.
You obviously, I mean, you go out of your way to help writers, and I know you've been really supportive of many writers. You got, somebody comes up to you and says, I have the greatest idea for a novel, and I know you've been told that many times.
Yeah.
What's your response, and how do you get somebody to think about what it really means to work at writing?
Oh, I don't think my response is much different than other writers. I mean, I'm of course, I'm not interested. I mean, I've made this point on my website and other places. You know, I don't care about ideas. Ideas are cheap. Ideas are easy. And most of the good ones have been used anyway. All we have is wrinkles on ideas. H.G. Wells did almost everything first, so, you know.
Right.
And it's not the idea anyway. It's the execution of it. You get many books that have the same basic idea when you look at them, and some of them are old-time classics of Western literature, and some of them are really horrible things that it takes to get through. It's all in the execution. Originality is great, but it's an overrated virtue, I think. Shakespeare wasn't very original. He was just very, very good. He could write exactly the same story that Hollins had or someone else had previously put down, but, you know, the way he did it elevated it to an all-time classic as opposed to whatever it had been before.
Yeah. But
the effect of technology and social media on the future of writing books, scripts, whatever. Do you see big changes?
Well, I have a blog, I have a website. Mm-hmm. I'm not on Facebook, I'm not on Twitter. There are many great things about the internet, and there are many bad things about the internet that I don't like or I think have bad effects, but you can't put the genie back in the bottle. I think the internet is here to stay, for both good and ill.
Mm-hmm.
I think the biggest changes that are coming, and they may not come in my lifetime, but they will come eventually, is really in the realm of television and film, which of course is an area that I've also worked into.
Yeah.
You know, as we see this now with computer games that are getting more and more elaborate, and you know, some of them look almost as good as movies with the computer-generated animation and things like that. Really amazing effects that are done by huge teams of people doing them as like doing a movie. But eventually, as the technology gets better and better, and you see this today with Photoshop and digital art, I mean, the old canvas and paint art, there's still people practicing it, but far more of the new artists, the young artists, are working digital. Some of them have never drawn a figure, they have never, you know, set a pencil to paper or dealt with a canvas or a palette. They're just working entirely on computers. I think that's going to come in movies and television too. Eventually you will just get one writer who will sit at his computer and will make a movie. Just one guy by himself. He'll do the dialogue and he'll create the characters and animate them and do the scenes and the special effects and the vistas. One guy can do all of that at the computer. Obviously, computers have to get a lot better, and you need the right guy. You're going to have a Shakespeare to do that. Someone who not only is a good storyteller, but is good at all the technical aspects of the medium. And, you know, when that happens, it's going to revolutionize filmmaking and television, because you won't need actors anymore, you won't need directors anymore, you won't need giant studios with multi-million dollar budgets to make giant blockbuster movies. You'll just need one guy with an imagination and his computer. Of course, knowing the way the world works, the giant multinational corporations will find some way to take it over, and, you know, they'll get a stranglehold on distribution or something like that. So the guy will have to sign all rights away to the thing that he made all by himself on a computer. So, but that's all the business aspect of it, which is a whole other world.
Bruce, thank you so much. It's really been a pleasure. You have any words of wisdom that you want to
keep reading,
some of the writers?
Yeah. Keep reading, everyone.
Yeah, yeah.
I love television, I love movies, but books are most magical of all.